You're listening to Irish Radio Canada's Roaming Abroad, and there was a book published in Ireland back in 2023, and it's just being released in North America, and it is called Dirty Linen by Martin Doyle. And Martin is the book's editor of the Irish Times, and the book offers a personal intimate history of the troubles seen through the microcosm of a single rural parish, which is the parish Martin grew up in, and it's part of both the Linen Triangle, which was the heartland of the North's defining industry, and the Murder Triangle, the Badlands devastated by paramilitary violence. And Martin lifts the veil of silence drawn over the horrors of the past, recording in a heart-rending detail the terrible toll the conflict took, and more than 20 violent deaths in a few square miles, and the long, tall trauma that it left behind. Martin, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on, Austin.
I found the a compelling read, and you know, given that I grew up in the 70s in Ireland and we emigrated in the late 80s, a lot of what you recounted were incidents and stories that I was, I would say, on the periphery aware of, because you would also know that in the south of Ireland, while we were aware, we were not aware. And that we were also, I suppose, we were so wrapped up at that age in my life. I was so wrapped up with putting food on the table and trying to do everything else that that was another world. But yet for you, your reality was, this is what you had: tit for tat murders. People you knew were there one day, not there the next day. And yet there were so many unanswered questions. So what prompted you to put pen to paper, to investigate, to say that there's something here that I need to deal with, both for yourself and as an author?
Thanks. Like, I would say at one level, what I experienced growing up in the north of Ireland is something that I've been thinking about all my life, been dwelling on, you know, the sectarianism, the violence, the discrimination, the political stalemates. But I never thought I was going to write a book about it. It was something that I, you know, maybe talked about every time I met up with my cousin who lived in England, and we were at school together, and we would talk about the sectarianism that we experienced at the state, effectively Protestant grammar school that we both went to. It was something like, it was like a scab that you picked at. But generally, yeah, I didn't think I was ever going to write a book about it. What happened was the initial prompt was quite different. I was asked by Paul McVeigh, who's a Belfast author, who wrote a very good novel, which is kind of like a coming of age novel and also a coming out novel in a way, called The Good Son. And he was doing an anthology of working class Irish writers, and he asked me to contribute to it. And I'm from a working class background. You know, my mum was a school dinner lady in my primary school. Went on to, you know, work in a linen mill in Donaghcloney. One of the victims was murdered a few years later, and she used the money that she earned there to open up a shop. My dad worked for Goodyear, the American tire company, the multinational in Craigavon, a few miles away. So, you know, I was from a working class background, but to be honest, I said to Paul, you know, it would feel almost dishonest for me to write about being working class, because, you know, growing up in the north of Ireland, class was the poor relation. It was, you know, it was all about, you know, what foot you kicked with. Were you a Catholic or were you a Protestant? Were you Irish or were you British? And I felt any disadvantage or any discrimination that I suffered was because of my religion or my national identity, not because of my class. That was to me the, you know, the big divide in the north, like the biggest demonstration of working class muscle, if you like, was the Ulster Workers' Council strike in 1974, which brought down the first power-sharing government in the north, the Sunningdale Agreement, which was a genuine, you know, compromise. You had Brian Faulkner was the unionist leader. You had Gerry Fitt was the leader of the SDLP, the Catholic Nationalist Party. And that was brought down by working class muscle, backed up by, you know, by Protestant trade unionists, backed up by loyalist paramilitaries. So, like, you know, to me, you know, it's like somebody sort of said, you know, working class unity, you know, that would be a good thing if it ever happened.
My dad always said, and I mentioned before we started, my dad's from Belfast, he said the thing about the North was you were defined from the cradle to the grave because your birth appeared in a particular newspaper and your death appeared in a particular newspaper.
Yeah, and you would be buried in a certain cemetery. Like, you know, I think even, you know, in a lot of cases, you know, Catholics and Protestants are buried separately as well.
So that the community that you grew up in and the times you grew up in, that definition was very much part of who everybody was.
Yeah. So what happened then? So I wrote a piece and I kind of, you know, I reflected on what it was like growing up in a working class housing estate in a Catholic village, but in a predominantly sort of Protestant neighborhood. And what that was like, and then passing my 11 plus, which was an exam, and then going to secondary school where, you know, we were very much a minority. Like, I think it was maybe 1 in 10 were Catholic. So I said it wasn't mixed, it wasn't integrated, it was diluted orange, a little joke. And, you know, that was quite a tough experience for me. And, you know, I was kind of, you know, called names like Fenian or Teg or whatever for 7 years or whatever. And I couldn't wait to get out, to be honest. And that was the experience of, you know, a lot of Catholics in the North, whether they went to a state school or just whatever they experienced in the workplace or in the neighborhood in which they lived. So that was part of it, but I also sort of, you know, touched on, you know, how the Troubles actually directly affected my community. So I wrote about, in particular, my milkman, Barney O'Dowd, who was shot but survived, but two of his sons were murdered, and one of his brothers was murdered in the family farmhouse in another part of the parish. So this kind of really brought the Troubles to my doorstep, literally, because Barney, you know, would have been delivering milk to the doorstep every day. And then at the weekend, he would come and collect the money. And he would let me kind of put his hand into this big sort of leather satchel, which he wore to keep the coins in, and lift out a big handful of coins. And to me, that was like untold riches. It was like a treasure chest. And his son Declan was our coal man. So, you know, he was one of the boys that was murdered. So this kind of really, this is the first murder in the parish that really kind of hit home for me.
Well, what age would you have been at that stage?
I was about, so that was in January 1976. So I would have been just eight years and a little bit. And, you know, another story that my mum told me was, you know, an elderly neighbour who lived a few doors down in the estate died, and my mum told me this, and my response was, who shot her? Mm-hmm. And that just sort of sums up for me just what, just how, you know, all pervasive political and sectarian violence was in my childhood, that I couldn't conceive that an elderly woman would die of natural causes. I just presumed immediately that she'd been assassinated. That just sort of shows you, even though I thought, or like years later, I would say I didn't really experience too much of the violence myself growing up in the countryside, but actually it permeated everything. You watch the news every night, there was shootings, there was bombings, you know, people getting killed, people getting sent to jail. It was the, you know, the air that you breathed, basically.
Given that it was the air that you breathed, were you conscious in any way of a fear that this was going to land into your own personal lap?
I definitely remember when mum and dad would go out, you know, at the weekend, maybe to, you know, with friends to dinner or to the pub or to some function, you know, I genuinely worried that they mightn't come home. I probably never articulated that, like, but there definitely was a heightened anxiety that I don't think I would have had in other circumstances. But I did other things that, you know, sort of suggest that I wasn't that aware or that sort of fearful. For example, going to the local disco in Bam Bridge and then walking home afterwards 3 miles in the dark, along a road leading to Portadown, which was, you know, a loyalist heartland. So, you know, in retrospect, that was an incredibly foolish thing to do, but I did it. So I think there was a kind of double think, or maybe it's just the foolhardiness of youth that you never think it'll happen to you, or you're just not that aware in sometimes that you're doing something that's risky. I do remember moving to Belfast when I went to Queen's University there for a year before getting the hell out. And I was living in a kind of an area called the Village, which was kind of near the university, but also near Windsor Park, which is where Northern Ireland play football, Linfield, the kind of, you know, main Protestant supported club in Belfast. And I definitely felt that I was kind of living in, you know, I was probably the only Catholic in the village sort of thing. And I definitely, felt uneasy living there and going to bed there at night, maybe listening to the news just before going to bed and hearing that some Catholic had been shot in the city. It kind of felt right on my doorstep in a different way there. And after a year in Belfast, I just wanted to get out because it just wasn't, you know, it was a dead place. There was just no kind of life to the place. And so I got away. I went to St. Andrews University. And I was there when my cousin came over for a ball. And so we're getting ready for it. I was putting on my tuxedo, my black tie. And then she tells me that Pat Feeney, a neighbour of mine that I'd grown up a few doors from, had been shot dead in the linen mill where my mum had worked. He was a night watchman or part-time. And I felt, you know, real survivor's guilt. I'd got away. Here's me with a black tie on going to a ball. And I'm thinking of all my neighbours wearing black ties going to Pat's funeral. So that kind of really hit home. So, and then what happened was, so back to how the book came about. So the article that I did for the anthology was also published in the Irish Times. And one of my milkman's sons, Noel, read it and got in touch and said, sorry, the bit that I didn't say was that Barney and his family had moved south of the border to near Trim in County Meath to get away from the violence. And what can I say? So I'd never seen him. I never saw him again. And then to hear out of the blue that he was still alive and to be invited to meet him was very moving, actually. This figure from your childhood, yeah, I hadn't seen since I was 8 years old. By this stage, I was, you know, in my 50s. And so I was brought to meet Barney, and he told me not just what happened to him and his family, but his whole life story, which was fascinating. Like, you know, coming from very little and building up a successful business, and then the trauma that he endured. And the detail that he told me that really kind of stopped me in my tracks was that after his wife died, the family had a get together and they made this decision that they wanted to rebury the two murdered brothers beside their mother in County Meath. And they did it themselves. They personally exhumed their own brother's bodies, you know, dug up the bones, put them in a fresh coffin and took it back across the border and buried it beside their mother. And like, to me, at one level, I was shocked. At another level, I was just really struck that this was like something from a Greek tragedy. It really encapsulated for me what I call the long tail of troubles trauma. This sense that something that had happened in 1976 and they were still dealing with that in their own way in 2000. And, you know, I had huge admiration for the way that they had rebuilt their lives. But I also felt that, the suffering that they had endured deserved to be marked. I do feel there have been a lot of books about the Troubles, but they're often written from the perspective of the politics or the history or the paramilitaries, you know, foregrounding, you know, what an IRA leader might say, or a Sinn Féin politician, or a unionist politician, or an SDLP politician, or a British politician. And frankly, for me, that's not my focus. I say in the book, the victims are my tribe. If I identify with anyone now, I identify with both Catholics and Protestants, innocent civilians and members of the security forces who were murdered, and the suffering that caused to their family and their friends. That to me is, the real legacy of the conflict.
When you say that, and I can't help but be conscious that the period of the Troubles was in a way when, the scab was pulled off. What was it, and what was there on the underside for a long time. And then after the Sunningdale Agreement, after the Good Friday Agreement, that in a way a healing was allowed to develop. But no matter what the wound is, the colour of the skin is never the same on a wound.
Yeah.
And I was very conscious. I was in Belfast in January, and I thought, fabulous. Like, I remember being in Belfast when I was 10 years of age and going out on Sunday to play and couldn't figure out why things like that. But I'm also very conscious that underbelly doesn't go away even when there's a scab that has happened and new skin appears to be forming, and how fragile things can still be.
It is fragile, but it's like, so I was like, I do show in my book that what happened in the modern Troubles had happened before. Like, I write about my grandfather's experience. Him and his sister were put out of work along with all Catholics in the linen industry along the River Ban. His sister Kate emigrated first to Canada, in fact, and then later to New York, and he never saw her again. So, when I spoke about Barney O'Dowd, never seeing him again was a bit of a callback to what happened to my grandfather and his sister. Right back to 1641, the prologue to the book is about a massacre which is alleged to have happened in my parish when some Protestants who had been driven out of County Armagh were ambushed, and up to 80 of them, including children, were supposed to have been forcibly drowned in the lake. And this was so shocking to me because that's where we used to go for picnics as children. It was like a local beauty spot. And I discovered a kind of a history which a teacher who had started his career at my school and had ended up in Black Rock in College in Dublin, one of the top schools in the country. He wrote a book called The Bloody Bridge, which kind of disputed the Trinity deposition. So Trinity College Dublin depositions, all these papers, these kind of reports, eyewitness accounts and second-hand accounts of atrocities in 1641 were kind of deposited in Trinity College Dublin as evidence of the terrible things that had been done by the native Irish against the Protestant settlers. But it's known that the accounts were hugely exaggerated. So this historian Fitzpatrick, in his account The Bloody Bridge, kind of went through it line by line and made arguments as to why some kings weren't true or other things had been exaggerated. But in the margin of the copy, which a friend of mine lent to me, somebody had underlined the bit about the Protestants being drowned in Kernan Loch by a guy called Phelim McCart, a local clan leader. And somebody in the late 19th century, early 20th century, possibly a local school teacher, had written, "The more the merrier, Phelim. I will say an Ave Maria for you, for your great deeds," or whatever. And to me, that was so shocking again. It was like, and particularly the beautiful handwriting, the calligraphy in which this sectarian sentiment was expressed. So it brought home to me that, you know, there's fault on both sides, and this stuff has been going on for centuries. And yet there is another side, there's a flip side to the narrative. Like in 1798, you had the United Irishmen, which were Protestants, Presbyterians, and Catholics had united, you know, fighting for a republic inspired by the ideals of the American and the French revolutions. And so, you know, it's not as if there's one single narrative and it was always thus and it always ever will be thus. There have been times when, you know, people have found common cause, maybe during the Second World War, you know, fighting, you know, the Germans, or there were kind of, you know, labor shortages, or sort of the huge poverty, the depression of the 1930s. There was, you know, some semblance of unity among working class Catholics and Protestants in Belfast. So, you know, what I'm trying to present here is, I hope, a nuanced narrative, which where everything isn't black and white. But, you know, I try to be honest and truthful. But the real heart of the book for me is talking to the families, the survivors, you know, the parents of children who were murdered, the sons or daughters of parents who were murdered, brothers of people who were murdered. And that's a way of bringing home the true human cost of 30 years of violence.
I noticed that you covered what were some very high news items, like the Miami show band massacre.
Yeah.
And there was the Guildford pub bombing as well, was it?
Well, actually, you know, there's a notorious Guildford pub bombing in England. There is a very little known Guildford, G-I-L-F-O-R-D, pub bombing in my parish.
Yes.
And actually, the point I make there is that, you know, when you Google the Guildford pub bombing in my parish, it automatically sends you to the bombing in Guildford, Surrey, in the south of England.
Yes.
And I make the point that, you know, how little a trace our suffering has left on the historical record, how easily, you know, the three deaths are erased, that even a Google search, you know, will divert you from the suffering of those three families who lost loved ones in my parish to an atrocity that happened hundreds of miles away.
Mm-hmm. And likewise with the Miami, how that had reverberations and probably got more attention and awareness north and south of the border.
Absolutely. Like, so it was a very high profile killing. So the Miami Show Band had played a gig in my parish in the Castle Ballroom in Banbridge. And it was sort of doubly significant to me, I guess, because, you know, not only was there the local connection, but also Steve Travers, one of the survivors, had moved to London after the atrocity and become a musician and a bit of an impresario in the London Irish music scene. And I was working at the Irish Post on the arts pages, including music. And Steve used to do a column for me about the music scene in London. So I knew Steve, you know, many years. I knew him in the 90s, long after the atrocity, but also the atrocity happened, you know, just, you know, outside my parish. So it was kind of like a double connection. Mm-hmm. And also the same weapons that were used to kill the O'Dowds, my milkman and my coal man and the rest of his family, were also used in the Miami Show Band massacre. And the Miami Show Band massacre was carried out by members of the British Security Forces, off-duty members of the Ulster Defence Regiment, including Robin Jackson, who was never convicted, even though he's linked to over 50 murders. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the area became known as a murder triangle, because between Newry, close to the border, Lurgan, just south of Loch Ness, just outside my parish, and across to Dungannon in County Tyrone, that area was bedeviled by loyalist paramilitaries killing innocent Catholics for 20 years, often, you know, with no one being arrested, no one being charged, and it later emerging that there was widespread collusion between members of the security forces, the RUC, the local police force, and the Ulster Defence Regiment, the local regiment of the British Army, and loyalist Protestant paramilitaries. And so, like, this is a stain, you know, in my view, in the view of many, on the British state, because they did not put the same effort, in my view, into combating loyalist paramilitaries as they did Republican paramilitaries, because the IRA were a threat to the state, whereas loyalist paramilitaries were a threat only to their Catholic neighbours.
What was very poignant was in some of what would have been the loyalist paramilitary operation, that I noticed that there was nearly a security fence around an area in advance of an attack that the loyalists seemed to be able to get through, but even local residents had difficulty, and they were able to get out from, and yet nobody saw anything.
Yeah. Like, if you think about it, going right back to the beginning, the first murderer that Robin Jackson, the Jackal, who was one of the leaders of the Ulster Volunteer Force, the Loyalist paramilitaries in mid-Ulster, his first murder was of Pat Campbell, a trade union leader in the shoe factory in Banbridge. They'd worked alongside each other, so, you know, they knew each other vaguely. And I suspect the reason Pat Campbell was killed was because he was a Catholic in a position of authority, which, Protestant bigots would find offensive. But the night that Pat Campbell was murdered, before the murder, there was another attack by the same killers in Lurgan, a town 7 miles away, in which they shot up a Catholic bar on the high street. So their preparation for murdering someone was to carry out another attack 7 miles away on a public house on the main street of another town. And yet they, you know, felt that they were safe to drive from one attack mm-hmm. to another town several miles away. Like, that's crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of, you know, who, you know, would go out to maybe rob a bank and the first thing that you would do would be to maybe, you know, rob a shop 7 miles away. Mm-hmm. That only makes sense if you are confident that you can get away with it, that you will not be stopped. The two last murders in the parish of the Kearns brothers, for which Robin Jackson was also the chief suspect. So that happened in the evening and during the day. And after the boys were murdered, the police were asking neighbours, had they seen anything suspicious, any suspicious activity in the area? And the embarrassing thing was that, you know, the suspicious activity or the unusual activity that neighbours had noticed was an extremely high, an unusually high security presence in the area earlier in the day. Like, the local priest said that he had been stopped twice in the run up to the murders. So, you know, the boy's father absolutely believes that there was security force involvement in his boy's murders. Nobody was ever charged. Files went missing, being moved from one police station to another. There is a big investigation by a man who is now, ironically, the chief constable of the police service in Northern Ireland, John Boucher. So he has spent several years investigating these linked murders of Catholic civilians by loyalist paramilitaries colluding with the security forces. He's missed deadline after deadline. He's actually stepped back from the involvement in the inquiry since he was appointed chief constable. But, you know, he still, you know, is obviously has got a connection to the case. And it's deeply frustrating. Like, a lot of these families, I would say, have been re-traumatized by being, you know, ask questions again by investigators seeking to kind of, you know, get their testimony, any information that might be helpful in building a case. And then for them to be left hanging, waiting, you know, year after year for some kind of resolution, I think is deeply unfair. And it's like kind of adding insult to injury, I would say, at this stage.
Martin, we could talk for hours, but it's a fascinating read, I have to say. And the other thing is that you, as we outlined earlier on, that what you did was you didn't just look at it from one side. You kind of says, yeah, the victims, the pain of victims was on both sides of the divide, and the perpetrators were on both sides. And yes, there is a history, but the pain that was experienced on both sides was a common loss. If someone loses a child, it doesn't matter where they were, what church they were going to, there was the loss of a child. And the tit for tat left so many broken hearts in every respect. And you did a fantastic job in reflecting that.
Thanks very much.
I want to thank you for taking the time to have a chat. I want to also direct people to say that the title of the book is Dirty Linen. And it's The Troubles in My Home Place, and it's Martin Doyle. And it is available. You can get it on all the platforms that you want. And it was now available on North America platforms, so it's available in Canada. I also want to thank you for taking the time, and it's been a wonderful chat. Thank you so much, Martin. And
a pleasure. Thank you, Austin.
Thank you.
All right.
Best of luck, and thank you for taking the time of researching and everything else.
Thank you. Lovely talking to you. All the best.